Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. Today on Route 51, we look forward to Labor Day with a special show marking the 100th anniversary of an event that took place right here in Wausau, Wisconsin, an event which changed the nature of workplaces all across America. I'm Glenn Moberg. 100 years ago today, September 1st, 1911, the company that would later become Wausau Insurance issued the very first workers' compensation policy to the company that would later become Wausau Paper. It came shortly after the state of Wisconsin passed the first workers' compensation law to be ruled constitutional. That law was dubbed the Great Compromise. It was hammered out by Wisconsin's progressive lawmakers in order to ensure that workers who were injured on the job would be compensated and cared for at agreed-upon rates that provided stability for businesses and freed them from the threat of lawsuits. The Wisconsin idea of workers' compensation was a dramatic recognition of society's responsibility to the workplace, and it was the very first form of social insurance in American history. It also served as the template for similar laws in every other state in the nation. My guest today here in our studio, John H. Jones, retired senior vice president of Wausau Insurance and a founding board member of the Workers' Compensation Research Institute. Joining us from our Wisconsin Public Radio studio in Madison, Ron Kent, retired Ask Me International Education representative and a voting member of the state's Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. And joining us by telephone, labor historian Andy Kirsten, Frankenthal Professor of History in the Department of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. He is the author of several books on American history, including two that have been published this year, Clarence Darrow, American Iconoclast, and The Battle for Wisconsin, Scott Walker, and the Attack on the Progressive Tradition. All three of my guests will also be participating in a panel discussion of this very topic, workers' compensation, next Wednesday evening, September 7th, right here at the Center for Civic Engagement on the UW-Marathon County campus. That forum is sponsored by the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service and the Center-Right Coalition of Wausau. It'll be moderated by UW-Marathon County Associate Professor of History Brett Barker, and it will also feature James Buchan, the Vice President of Government Relations for Wisconsin Manufacturing and Commerce. Mr. Buchan was not able to appear on this program because of a personal conflict. But if you're interested in what we're talking about this hour, we do recommend that you show up for that. Again, it's next Wednesday evening, September 7th, at the Center for Civic Engagement on the UW-Marathon County campus. Well, we've got a lot of history to talk about, a lot of developments that are still playing out in business-labor relations in Wisconsin and across the nation. If you would like to join us, if you've got questions or comments, you can give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Andy, welcome from Green Bay.
Thank you.
And Ron, welcome from Madison.
Thank you.
And John, welcome right here in Wausau. And John, I want to start with you. The first workers' compensation policy was issued by what was then called Employers Mutual Liability Insurance Company. That was a company that would later become Wausau Insurance, the company you worked for. And it was a policy issued to the Wausau Sulfate Fiber Company, which would later become Wausau Paper's Mosinee Mill. That policy really defined Wausau Insurance as a company, didn't it?
It did. It recognized that a group of the Wausau business leaders, when they saw the opportunity after the law was enacted, passed in May, and then first executed the 1st of September, they realized in that interim that there was an opportunity where they could, in putting together an approach to what are we going to do now that the law has changed, agreed to self-fund an opportunity and keep a mutual insurance company located in Wisconsin in the process of being a major writer of workers' compensation insurance.
And that company was actually formed in 1911, the same year the law was passed.
Exactly. They recognized an opportunity, and they took advantage of it. And with a mutual company, you don't have stockholders. Policyholders own the company, and it's in the policyholders' best interest to make that effort for safety on the job and for essentially keeping their workers' compensation rates low.
Why did the paper mill need this policy, and how did it help both the businessmen who purchased it and the workers who were at the mill?
Well, before the law changed, it was very difficult for an injured worker to seek wage replacement, medical attention. There were old English standards that really prohibited an ease of suing the employer. With workers' compensation, it became a no-fault system, and workers would receive wage replacement and medical. And the opportunity presented itself that they could, as they did, hire the first employee who focused on job safety. It was in their best interest to reduce industrial accidents, keep mm-hmm. their premiums low, and as a result, benefit from the new change in the law.
And that was this very day, 100 years ago today, September 1st, 1911. Now, employers' mutual liability was formed by the leaders of the Wausau Group. This is a group of very progressive Wausau business leaders, former timber barons who really created the area's first diversified economy. They were also great supporters of the arts, education, parks, and other things which not only enhanced our quality of life back then, but still things we enjoy in Wausau today.
That's correct. The interesting part of that grouping was that they formed a mutual insurance company, not a stock company. And that created quite a ripple in the insurance world, where the policyholders actually own the company, and it's in their best interest to make certain that their losses do not detract from the company's performance. So they had a real incentive to stress workplace safety. They had a real incentive because mutual companies paid dividends to policyholders based on performance. So they were able to keep their money, as they say, locally and not have to deal with disinterested owners such as stockholders who may or may not have any interest in workers' compensation but are buying stocks simply because it looks like a good investment.
Andy Kirsten, let's turn to our labor historian here. What were business-labor relations like in the early part of the 1900s in this state and for that matter, across America?
If you go back in that time, the turn of the 20th century, there was a tremendous amount of conflict between labor and employers, and particularly in the industrial scene. And that conflict was reflected in the politics of the era. And so at the turn of the 20th century, there was a much broader spectrum of American politics. On the right were sort of the conservative business leaders, and on the left, far beyond what we would consider progressives, were socialists. And they differed greatly, and sometimes the conflicts were quite bitter, both in the state houses and nationally and also on the shop floor. And the progressives who we're talking about today, we're in the middle. The American politics were sort of center-left, and the progressives were the people that business folk trusted, and workers and their representatives, for example, in Madison, could rely upon to get some compromises that helped level the economic playing field.
So we think today, Andy, of progressives as being often on the far-left end of the political spectrum, but you're telling me that when progressives were actually a force in this state, that really isn't an accurate description.
That's true, and the progressives had a very tenuous relationship with radicals in the state, and socialists in particular. Socialists agreed to work with them because that's how you got things done, but they had a conflict too. And the question is, to the degree which these reforms, like workers' compensation, what degree did they benefit the workers' interests over the employer's interests? And that compromise, which resulted in the first state law that was allowed to be constitutional, that compromise was not quite what the socialists in the state wanted. People like Frank Weber, they wanted something more, something that helped workers even more than what they finally got. But progressives were great compromisers. They sort of tried to square that circle, And they did a very good job in doing that. It's lasted for a century.
And that is the title of that forum that all of you are going to be participating in this Wednesday, The Great Compromise. To people who are not really students of Wisconsin history and are probably surprised by what you just said, Andy, a little bit of background. Who were these socialists in Wisconsin? How influential were they? How many served in the legislature? How many served in municipal governments?
Well, mostly the socialists, which were, as socialists come, they were pretty middle-of-the-road people. It came out of the Milwaukee area, and these are those German immigrants and their children who transformed that part of the state. And they're known by various names. You might call them bread-and-butter socialists, worried more about the average everyday life of workers and average people, but they also are known by the phrase sewer socialists, not because of any mudslinging, but rather one of their great ideas was pure drinking water, and they helped set up the first municipal drinking water system in Milwaukee, which was not only profitable, but also very popular. They eventually sent people to Madison, and in this period, in the early 20th century, about two dozen legislators are not only connected very tightly with Wisconsin State Federation of Labor, but also with the socialist movement out of Milwaukee. And they're the ones that are pushing for reforms and working with progressives like Bob La Follette and later Francis McGovern.
Francis McGovern was the governor at that time, correct?
Right, and he comes out of that Milwaukee progressive tradition. And so McGovern's interest is maintaining capitalism, but humanizing it. And if you just allow me, I pulled a quote from him when he signed the bill. And what he said was that McGovern, quote, advocated a more enlightened and humane system of compensating workmen injured in the course of their employment. And that's what the progressives are doing. They're not looking to give workers all the power in any situation, but a kind of compromise that maybe is equally dissatisfying to employers and workers, mm-hmm. but also works together to create an economic system that doesn't put all the power and advantages into the hands of a very few group of people. And they know, for example, in Wausau, Madison, Milwaukee, even Green Bay had some progressives, that to the degree they create prosperity in these systems of regulation and reform, it's the degree which everyone in the community will profit.
You know, that quote you just gave me from Francis McGovern, honestly, it reminds me of something that Dave Olby said, who served as congressman here in north central Wisconsin for 40 years. He said, our job is to take the rough edges off of capitalism so it works for everybody.
Right, and that's a very progressive way of thinking, where if you're a radical socialist, you, of course, want to transform the system and sometimes maybe limit severely or end capitalism. These socialists in Wisconsin, and the reason probably why it works so well, were pretty middle of the road. They realized that someone has to represent worker interests. They did. And they worked very hard with conservatives and with progressives to find solutions to help average people. And this was at a time when really the factories could be quite horrific. And I have stories in my own family. But I'll give you a statistic from a little bit later. In the 1940s, mm-hmm. in the first few years of the war, more people died in factory injuries than died on the battlefront. It was a serious, serious problem. And when workers were hurt, or when they died and their families had left with problems, they often sued employers. And this is the other part of the story. Those common law traditions that John mentioned were working very well for employers and helping them defend themselves against workers, but not always. And here's the point. They began to lose cases at the turn of the 20th century.
And if you lose a case in court, all you have to do is lose one or two, and if the judgment is big enough, that can bankrupt your entire company.
Exactly. And what business people want is predictability and regularity. And the insurance system in Wisconsin, based on the on things that weren't owned by stockholders because they had troubles with those in the past, but a mutual would allow for a regular, predictable cost of injuries and deaths. And so that was part of factory life at the turn of the 20th century, and they're looking for a way to rationalize that, and progressives loved that. They were interested in rationalization and efficiency. And workers, and represented by the socialists, could agree to some reform, which was later modified, and it continues to be modified, to improve the system.
Well, Ron Kent, we haven't gotten to you yet. You were the international education representative for AFSCME. You've conducted courses on labor law and workers' compensation for local, state, and county governments. How did this early history of workers' compensation that Andy's been talking about lead to the system that we've got today?
Well, I think the key to this is that it's provided a foundation of a very rational system that was envisioned by John R. Commons and Charles McCarthy, who helped write the law and shepherded it through the legislature with, naturally, the help of Francis McGovern. But it provided a foundation for the present law that we have in the state, trying to balance the interests of labor and the employers in some rational way, so that instead of fighting and litigating cases in court all the time and jury trials, the parties came together with a rational system of compensation or indemnity payments, as they're known as, to the worker, as well as full medical coverages, as well as death benefits and coverage for disease and illness, which were innovations that were added to the law over history, all through the history of our state. And these are progressive changes that were added to the framework statute that began in 1911 and was modeled. Of course, Commons was influenced by what happened in Germany under the Bismarckian system that was evolved starting in 1884 and was influenced by those early developments.
Well,
they wanted something more.
Yeah, Ron, you're going over a lot of people's heads right now. But there was something that they were able to use as sort of a template, you're saying, that happened in Europe?
Yes. I mean, many of the provisions that you find in the Wisconsin law about coverage as well as medical care were part of the European ideas that existed in Germany. And the injured workers there were paid medical benefits. They were also paid a small indemnity payments. About two-thirds of their wage was given to them. And the statute here as well was designed to reimburse workers eventually for about two-thirds of their income, ideally, initially, and then also cover medical expenses.
I guess it would make sense with all of the German immigrants in Wisconsin at that time that they would bring those ideas with them from the homeland.
Yes, and they influenced the legislation, as Andy just mentioned. They were very influential, Frank Weber and Frederick Brockhausen, being two of the very influential people in the legislature. Brockhausen was an immigrant from Germany, and he brought these ideas with him. And, of course, they wanted to make sure that it was much stronger, because Bismarck used it as a way to try to crush the Social Democratic Party of Germany. He wanted to get rid of them, actually. But Brockhausen and others wanted to make sure that the workers had basic rights and basic coverages, and made sure that it was not used as a political football.
We're talking to Ron Kent, Andy Kirsten, and John Jones about something that happened 100 years ago this very day, September 1st, 1911, the very first workers' compensation policy issued in Wausau, Wisconsin. It was the first piece of social legislation in American history. I'm Glenn Moberg. It's a special Route 51 Labor Day show. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742.
Support for WPR comes from Rely Local Wausau, working to build the local economy and strengthen the community by making local business everybody's business. Learn more about locally owned and operated businesses at relylocal.com.
We've also got John Jones, formerly of Wausau Insurance, and Ron Kent, formerly of Ask Me, and labor historian Andy Kirsten, talking about the Great Compromise, the very first constitutional law which enabled workers' compensation. It was a policy that was initially issued right here in Wausau. And Ron Kent, why was this law ruled constitutional when other ones weren't?
Well, the founders were very smart. John R. Commons and Francis McGovern realized that they had to make it voluntary. And that meant that the framework statute was originally adopted as a voluntary system where employers could opt in, and then as a result, they would be protected from lawsuits and the other kinds of litigation would go away. As a consequence of making it voluntary, the courts viewed the law in a much more favorable light. And not only did the Wisconsin Supreme Court uphold it, but in 1917, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that these types of laws, including Wisconsin's, were constitutional because they were voluntary laws that allowed employers to opt in or opt out. And I have to mention that if employers decided not to opt into the law, they lost their common law defenses that they could use in defending their actions
workers. It was in their best interest to opt in. And Andy Kirsten, was it the mandatory nature of some of these other laws that led to the unconstitutionality of them?
Yes, and I think there are actually a handful of them going back to the late 19th century. And New York's was the broadest and most comprehensive, and that's the one that got booted out right before Wisconsin passed their law. And it was that comprehensive nature, or the sort of half-baked nature. It was neither, you know, beast nor fowl. And the in-between creates that uncertainty, but also creates then that sort of undue regulatory environment where something is halfway done. And so they sort of limped along, and Wisconsin seemed, once again, to get it right down the middle.
All right, Andy, hold that thought. We're going to be back with more on workers' compensation. This half hour has gone much too quickly, right after this break for news.
Support for WPR comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More at umr.com.
We're back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today it's a special Labor Day show as we look at the very first workers' compensation policy issued 100 years ago today, September 1st, 1911, by the company that would later become Wausau Insurance to the company that would later become Wausau Paper. We have John Jones, a retired executive with Wausau Insurance. We also have Ron Kent, who is a former Ask Me official who sits on the board that determines policy for workers' compensation cases, at least in terms of the law. He's with us, as is UW Green Bay labor historian Andy Kirsten. And gentlemen, I feel like this is really a history lesson that we've got going here, especially listening to that news story by Mike Simonson over the break. And he's talking about all the labor history in Wisconsin at the turn of the century, labor leaders getting kidnapped, people getting shot to death. You know, we think of the acrimony and the fighting between conservatives and labor leaders and the things that went on with the collective bargaining law in Madison. But Andy Kirsten, this has been going on quite a while in Wisconsin.
Right. I always tell my students that history doesn't repeat itself, but it sometimes rhymes. And it seems that we've returned to a period when that great bargain that seemed to be struck in the 30s about how you're going to create prosperity and how you're going to build up the working class and the middle class, it seems that bargain is maybe a little bit frayed. It may be ignored now. The question I'm often asked is this the end of the labor movement? This may be the end of the beginning. I think we're going to have to return to that period when we begin to wonder what are the mechanisms by which average people can put a life together.
If you'd like to join the conversation, our lines are open, and we have no callers right now, so you can get right through. I know it's been a history lesson for the first half hour, but if you'd like to comment on the history of Wisconsin's labor movement, the first workers' compensation law, and where things are going, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Ron Kent, I'm wondering if you can expound on what Andy just said.
Well, I think Andy makes a good point, and it doesn't repeat itself, but there takes different forms. The labor movement has had times when it's forged ahead greatly in the 30s and the post-World War II period. And in the public sector, the 60s were the great time of growth. But there were times when people did not have labor laws. Public employees, for example, did not have labor laws in Wisconsin since the earliest part of Wisconsin's government history until 1959. So they had to find other ways to lobby, to pressure governments to act responsibly, to offer the eight-hour day, to give basic conditions. And so the labor movement's had these ups and downs, and all throughout its history of Wisconsin. It's a very rich history indeed.
And John Jones, you have anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I would, because while it is a very discouraging past, and the passage of the Workers' Compensation Act was at bright light, as you go around the country, other states replicated the process of beginning a statutory workers' compensation system. But what's unique about Wisconsin's system is the degree to which other states hold us in high regard, and that's not by accident. The Workers' Compensation Advisory Council that really came into effect around 1975, and I had the privilege of serving as a non-voting member from 1980 to 1992, advises the department and, in essence, prepares the potential revisionary legislation for the legislature to consider and adopt. It's a most unique process when you compare it to other states where you kind of depend on the political winds to tailor the reform. If the conservatives get into office, they're interested in retarding benefit growth and looking at opportunities to save costs. And if liberals get in, they talk about a fair replacement wage, aggressive medical treatment, vocational treatment, coverage for occupational disease. Wisconsin has not moved from the crisis success and crisis mode as other states have, and in large part it is due to the advisory council.
And you were a non-voting member of that council.
Exactly.
There were how many non-voting members?
There are three non-voting members. They represent the insurance industry. It tends to be a stock, a mutual, and one other. And there are five labor representatives and five management representatives. And as an insurance representative, you learn to keep your mouth closed and your eyes and ears open and serve as you can to counsel based on experience you may have in Wisconsin or other states that might shed some value to the discussion. The discussion is well worth buying a ticket if they would sell them, because it's interesting to see how interests are represented. But in the end, a deal is a deal, and when they put it together, the agreement is no one shall speak evil of the deal, and it goes to the legislature for their consideration and for their passage.
When those deals are worked out, you've got actually the chairman votes too, right? So you've got 11 voting members?
No, actually, it is reached by consensus.
Okay. So Ron, you're currently serving on this position, on this board as a voting member. So yes. You never have a situation in which there's like a 6-4 vote or a 7-3 vote? They have to...
That was not my experience, but I came off the board in 1992. Maybe Ron has had a different experience.
Ron, how's it working now?
Well, essentially, it is five labor members, five management members, and the chair now has the right to vote if he or she decides to do so. Normally, we come to a unanimous vote, and no bill has been brought forward without that unanimous vote.
And this is all for things like updating the existing workers' compensation law, right, which sets certain amounts for certain kinds of damages?
Yes. Any kind of change in the statutory framework, whether it's for penalties, for failure to comply, to increasing benefits, or changing the insurance system in some way, or medical benefits, all have to be agreed upon by the parties at the table. And that's why the insurance representatives are there to advise us. We also have three medical liaisons, the State Medical Society, the Wisconsin Hospital Association is there, along with the Chiropractor Association, to advise us on medical issues as well.
So you've really got experts determining these policy changes. Now, when you draw these up and you reach a conclusion, send it to the state legislature. Does the legislature usually just rubber stamp it?
Normally, we have to appear before the legislature with the departmental representatives to explain our bill. And sometimes these hearings can be quite, I would say, contentious in some cases. But overall, it's always work well when the parties come in together and present the evidence to the legislative bodies, and they generally approve all the statutory changes recommended by the council because we've clearly spent a lot of time studying them and getting the best information possible before agreeing upon an item.
How do they pick the business members and the labor members of this compensation advisory council?
From my understanding, on the labor side, the state AFL-CIO asks member unions to submit names of individuals who are qualified to sit on such the council, such as myself. We have Brad Swanda from the UAW. We have other people who have served on the council from various union steel workers, such as Bob Glaser. And on the business side, the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce has a very big role, as do a number of other business associations that submit names, and large corporations, and sometimes their legal counsels serve on the council at the request of the business side.
How do you guys get along? I mean, especially in the last year, we have been so used to business interests and labor interests being at loggerheads. How do you, as a retired Ask Me member, sit down with a guy like James Buchan of Manufacturers and Commerce Organization? You know, are you able to see eye to eye and get along cordially, or is there some acrimony that's added to these negotiations?
Well, and we try to keep everything on a very high level. Items are studied. Each proposal is given due consideration. We have some very heated exchanges on certain items sometimes, but these are necessary to vet the proposals correctly, to flush out the research that's been done on each proposal. But in the end, at the end of the day, after all these sessions are held and these sidebars are held, as well as individual discussions with members, we usually come together on a bill that is a compromise proposal. No one side is going to game the other in this system.
And John Jones, was that your experience too?
Absolutely. The process really was a vetting process. The motto was, let's find an opportunity to reach agreement and present a united advisory council to the legislature. And remember that we'll be back again. So if you didn't get what you wanted this time, there was an opportunity to marshal your assets and rebid that issue at the next advisory council sessions.
Is Wisconsin unique in having this set up?
No. Other states have advisory councils, but none, to my knowledge, have had the successful track record as Wisconsin's. Our ability to essentially show the legislature that we can move this body of laws forward to be responsive to the needs of workers and employers without acrimony and without individual legislators feeling they have to represent some constituent complaint, that may disrupt the orderly process of workers' compensation. They have confidence in the advisory council, and the advisory council has confidence in the process.
1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. 1-800-780-9742. And let's go to the phones. We have John in Grand Rapids. John, you're on Route 51.
Hi, I was just listening to your guest earlier speak about the ORDOC strike in Superior. I was originally from Superior, and I was not aware of that. I was involved in several strikes up there when the teachers went on strike as a student, and my father was an employee of the city, and they went on strike in the 60s. And I got one of my first jobs as a grain miller, or as a prover for the state after the grain miller strike was settled in, I think it was 79.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you know, one of the things I find very interesting is they don't teach this stuff in school. There's no way for anyone to know the history of the labor movement in this country. I find that really disturbing, especially with what's going on right now and the direction that we're going with the way we treat workers in this country. Their wages going down, CEO wages going up. I was just wondering if your guests had any thoughts about that.
Well, let me turn to Andy Kirsten, because he's a guy who does teach this in school, although it's at the college level at UW Green Bay. He's a labor historian. Andy Kirsten, are we failing young people by not letting them know everything they should know about the labor movement?
I think so. But the good news is that a couple years ago, the Wisconsin legislature passed a law, and Governor Doyle signed it, that mandates the teaching of labor history in the public schools. And they're working out now how that will be implemented. But the point is, it's not merely a labor history that just focuses on strike and conflict, I think misses the point a little bit. Those are flashpoints, and they're very important, and Frank Little is a person that everybody should know a little bit about. But the larger arc of Wisconsin history shows that cooperation between the state employer or manager, private managers, and workers has always been present. And there's been a lot of negotiation in good faith. There have been some serious arguments. But if you look at the broad sweep of Wisconsin history, there's a lot of coming together to sort these things out. And I think that's what makes Wisconsin a little bit exceptional. But I also think that's what makes these progressive solutions work so well. And you can take the example, as we just described, about worker compensation and the experts getting together representing labor management in the state, that great triangle in American history. But if you go to other things as well, you'll see the same thing in the Wisconsin retirement system, which runs as a progressive entity in the state. And there's some news about this recently as well, about how that's working now. And so I think you're quite right that we need to talk about these issues constantly as families, and to your children, and to students, because it still affects us today. And if we don't get these things right, and if we get too emotional as we deal with these history and the present issues, then the solutions that are in the middle seem to fall off the table.
John, we've still got you on the line. Do you have a follow-up?
Well, you mentioned workers' compensation, and I happen to have been injured on the job, and I don't know that the public is aware. I had back surgery as a result of a work-related injury, and I was out of work for 11 months. The law required my employer to take me back. This is 1985 and 86. They required my employer to take me back for retraining, and after the retraining was done, the employer fired me. And then what they did is they said, you know what, we'll hire you back, but you got to start all over again at minimum wage, and the 4 years of work history you have with us doesn't matter. So I don't know that people are aware of some of the consequences of workers' compensation laws. It's not all about the worker, I'll tell you that.
John, thank you so much for the phone call. And Ron Kent, I want you to react to what John just said.
Well, that is an egregious case of retaliation, and certainly if one were to be fired under a union contract, it should have been litigated through arbitration as an unjust firing under just cause. But had not had a union, retaliatory firings sometimes are governed by the rules of the worker comp law, insofar as that it's an unreasonable matter to rehire, and there's a one-year penalty of back wages owing to the worker for such behavior that is illegal under our law currently. So there should have been a complaint filed so that he could at least got one more year of pay restored to him through that illegal action. I would like to see stronger penalties than that, but that has not been granted to us through the process at this point. But it is a serious problem in some minor cases or major cases for the individual, and it shouldn't happen in our state at all, ever. It's a great injustice, and most cases are not settled that way, but there are a few outliers like that that should be addressed in the statute.
John, thank you so much for the phone call. We got to take a quick break. 1-800-780-9742. We'll try to get another call or two in. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from Northwind Renewable Energy in Stevens Point, partnering with agricultural and commercial industries to invest in central Wisconsin's renewable energy future. More about the benefits of solar for business at northwindre.com.
We've also got, boy, a jam-packed panel here and a very complicated but very interesting discussion of Wisconsin's labor history and some of the things that have led to the way the modern-day workforce exists not only in Wisconsin but across the nation. 100 years ago today, the state's very first workers' compensation laws, we head into a Labor Day, that first policy issued in Wausau by the company that would become Wausau Insurance. We have a Wausau Insurance executive, a former executive, John Jones, with us. Also a former Ask Me official who sits on the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council, Ron Kent, and Andy Kirsten, who is a labor historian at UW Green Bay. Ron, I want to ask you, as somebody who sits on this board, how does Wisconsin stack up against the rest of the country in terms of our workers' compensation policy?
We have a very good record overall of providing some of the best coverages in the nation. We have a great return to work results. The surveys done by insurers of injured workers indicate the about an 85% approval rating of the medical care that are given to injured workers in our system. So the areas that we can improve upon, I think, would be in the area of trying to hold down some of the medical costs that have been skyrocketing recently, and that has been coming from the management side, but also the labor side. We see the necessity to try to deal with that issue seriously. And we could improve some of the indemnity payments, meaning the cash payments to injured workers that they need to live a decent life, especially the long-term disabled could use additional monies to help them in this economy.
Is that the greatest threat right now to the system, the spiraling cost of health care, medical care?
Well, it's one of the very important ones that could threaten if utilization or use of the system goes up. Right now, we're controlling on a case-by-case basis. Our costs are very reasonable on a case-by-case basis because use is infrequent. We have less injuries than many other states. We've had good safety programs in the state of Wisconsin, conscientious unions and employers who have been trying to work on that. But if utilization were to increase, medical care could be a very significant cost driver in the system, and it is right now as a rule. So we have to watch it very carefully, and we also have to watch the indemnity side as well.
Okay. John Jones, we've only got about a minute left. Before we go, I want to ask you, do you wish Wausau Insurance was still with us today as an independent company based in central Wisconsin?
I certainly would wish that. It is disappointing to see that their financial condition could not result in at least a partner that would keep the trade name alive and allow them to continue their good work in workers' compensation. But that's life.
And Andy Kirsten, your new book is titled The Battle for Wisconsin, Scott Walker and the Attack on the Progressive Tradition. An open-ended question. I need a short answer from you. Is this state still a progressive state?
Absolutely.
Well, that's a very short answer. Well, what do you think the future is for unions and for things like workers' compensation, the future of collective bargaining? Do you think the measures enacted by the governor this year will be rolled back, or are unions going to become a thing of the past?
Well, in the short term, I think the labor movement is going to have a hard time operating in the state. But if you take the longer arc of American history, there are only a certain set of solutions that allow people to, and especially workers, to build better lives for their children. So I suspect that no matter what happens in the next few years, we'll come back to this idea that workers have rights. And the system functions best when people sit down at the bargaining table and hash out their differences and also their agreements.
We want to thank today's guests, John Jones, retired senior vice president with Wausau Insurance, Ron Kent, retired Ask Me International Education rep, and UW-Green Bay labor historian Andy Kirsten. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to Tim Allen for technical assistance from our UW-Madison studio. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. A reminder that all of today's guests will be featured on a panel discussion of workers' compensation next Wednesday evening, September 7th, at the Center for Civic Engagement on the UW Marathon County campus in Wausau, with our moderator, Brett Barker, professor of history, and James Buchan, vice president of government relations for Wisconsin Manufacturing and Commerce. Remember Labor Day on Monday? Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. Thanks for riding along with us today. Until next week, we're heading out of town.